So Jeff, good morning.
Good morning, David.
And welcome back to the Daily Evolver. And today we're going to talk about all of this economic conversation about, well, it starts with the budgets, and we have a budget until September, but we're already starting to talk about 2012 and 2013. Debt ceilings issues are going to be about whether we can raise the debt ceiling and all the rest of that. So there's a lot in play, and it's not just in the United States, but it's also worldwide, and we see how events are affecting any number of perspectives on what we should do. Spending versus taxes and all those different worldviews and sort of points of view about all that. But right now we have this equally added pressure that if we don't do something that significantly looks at this debt, then from a worldwide credit situation, the U.S. bonds may, you know, may be defaulted. And then where is that going, right? Well, that hasn't happened. That hasn't even been threatened to happen since 1995. That was the last time it was,
right,
for about a month. And so what do you see in terms of just how to even start this potentially a simple but yet very complex conversation?
This is where Integral comes in handy again. I know I always start there, but it's because we have the means to take a look at the bigger patterns of history. And, you know, there's nothing mystical schmystical about them. It's just they're available to us. And we see that cultures, as they grow, the population wants to feel more secure. They want to have more and more of safety net, more protection from the vicissitudes of life and the ups and downs of life. And that's appropriate. That creates decent lives for people. Mm-hmm. And we have to keep our economy growing. And because it's ultimately the private sector that is the generator of wealth that then the public sector distributes. Mm-hmm. And so those are the big patterns. And if you look at the pattern that the United States and the developed world in general has gone through in the last 20 years, the last generation, or maybe even longer, it's that spending continues to increase, largely because, you know, if the good news that people are living longer, we have a lot more medical interventions to keep people living longer, and we're really living in a much better world. Mm-hmm. It's a much more expensive world.
Right.
And some of the rules that were set up in the beginnings of the safety net, where we had, for instance, you know, 15, 16, 17 workers supporting each retiree, mm-hmm. we're, and many developed countries are now getting to the point where there's 4, 5, 3 in the United States workers supporting each retiree coming up. Mm-hmm. And, you know, these things just become unsustainable. Plus, developed countries want to, particularly the United States, wants to make their values, to spread them across the world. And so we still have troops in South Korea and Japan and Germany. And, you know, we can't seem to ever leave a country that we ever fought a war in. You know, now we're talking about Iraq and Afghanistan and Libya, and these are very, very expensive.
Yeah.
And so, you know, just in this last minute, I touched on three of the huge issues.
Well,
medical, retirement, and defense are huge issues that have a momentum of their own that unless they are intelligently checked and reestablished and reformulated as we go, you know, we just have to deal with crisis after crisis after crisis. So those are two ways to do it.
Sure. The thing that we've talked about a lot through a lot of subjects is as we expand our perspectives, our circle of care expands.
Yes.
So we start to take for granted that in an abundant culture, which certainly the United States is, that, and this is where this ideological argument comes down, the liberals will say we have a responsibility to take care of those that can't take care of themselves. So when you look at now Medicare and Medicaid is up for grabs again. I mean, these are programs that have been there for a long time. The Republicans are now challenging that they want to fundamentally restructure them. So you go with the elderly, right? And certainly, as you pointed out, baby boomers are about ready to head into this zone. So this huge bubble of population and the questions of can Social Security support all those things, right? And then you have, you know, Medicaid, which is, you know, the poor. I mean, people that can't afford health care and can't deal with their own things because they end up at the lower end of the spectrum, that liberals say we have some responsibility to them. And conservatives have another point of view, which sometimes feels kind of heartless, but it is their point of view in a certain way of just saying, no, people need to fend for themselves and we can support a little bit. But but ultimately, this is capitalism, this is democracy, and, you know, people got to figure it out, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and I'm with you in the sense that I naturally understand the liberal position because I'm a liberal. You know, I live in Boulder. I left Western Pennsylvania. I knew I was I was a liberal when I was 11. You know, and I was going to leave. But when I go back to talk to my relatives who still live in Western Pennsylvania, or, and they're working and they're working hard and they're getting up in the morning and they're doing their job, and they're providing for their family, and it is not easy. And they're doing jobs they don't love, and they're not finding personal meaning in their work like I am, or many of my friends here in the liberal means and the green means. I mean, meaning becomes really important. And there's a resentment among people who work hard for a living at jobs that they don't find meaningful. And I don't blame them, because they, first of all, realize that they're playing by the rules that of the game that they were set up for them. And then what really bothers them in a visceral way that we liberals can't see, because we see it differently, we think differently, and also in many cases we don't live close as they do with people who are just milking the system. And they can see them milking the system. And they deeply resent that they're being taxed so that these people that they see next door to them who are, you know, questionably on Social Security or whatever it may be. I mean, I don't know the details of it, but I know that it's potent. And we liberals need to feel into that so that we can understand that anger and resentment that comes from conservatives that we otherwise just write them off as they're crazy or they're stupid or they're evil or they've been co-opted by the corporate media. And all of that stuff that is just makes liberals feel a lot more secure about staying in their own worldview. So, you know, we want to look at that because as integralists, we see that the battle that's happening, and I know we all want to say those politicians in Washington and look at the corruption and look at the posturing and look at, you know, the ways that they demagogue things and whatever it might be. And, you know, that's politics. Politics is basically the movement and physics of power. And we're living in a country in the United States, 300 million people, who see things radically differently. You know, just that liberal conservative things. And there's many other fractures in society that are appropriate. That's how we evolve. And that's the way we're doing it. And from an integral perspective, we want to be able to feel into all of those streams because they have to be managed. And that's where I think we are so lucky to have a president like Obama, who really sees his role as conducting the orchestra. He's not, and I know it's to the eternal disappointment of
well,
liberals,
liberals, yeah,
that he's not, you know, leading the charge and in front of the battle and, you know, defeating the other side. He doesn't see it that way. He sees that all of these streams of karma, basically, you know, collective karma in the lower quadrants, need to be online. They are online. And they all have a piece of the truth. And so where we are then is we've had, as I said, this 20, 30 years of basically increasing spending, decreasing taxes, and borrowing the rest so that we can continue to live these lives. Right. And it's just, you know, unsustainable. Mm-hmm. It's untenable. And so something needs to happen, and both sides see a different thing that needs to happen. So the conservatives have basically a natural antipathy towards government.
Sure.
Liberals have a natural antipathy towards the corporate state, if you will. And so both of them, particularly to the degree that they're playing tribal politics where my side wins, your side loses, the conservatives want to strangle government. They want to turn off the oxygen so that this thing actually has to right-size itself. And they believe in that. And that's an ideological belief system. And earlier we were talking about Rand Paul, who says, yeah, forget the debt ceiling. We're not passing it. Let the country default.
Right.
Now, everybody thinks that would be a catastrophe. Well, it would, but it would be a useful catastrophe for people who want to see the government.
From that point of view.
Yeah, exactly.
But here's the interesting thing to me is that when you say the last 30 years, we've obviously had Republican and Democratic administrations.
Yes.
The last time the budget, in quotes, was balanced was under Clinton.
Yes.
And a lot of that, I mean, when people look at it, say that there was a great upturn in the economy and it fueled into that.
Yes.
And then, right. And so, yes, he did, but there were some circumstances. Bush for 8 years, right? This is sort of the irony of this. Not that I want to take the liberal view, because I sort of sit in the middle. I'm for progress wherever it comes. I want to see, because I don't believe in the taxes either. I get into the pain as a liberal when I pay my taxes and say, what are these taxes going for, right? And you see the incredible waste in government and all that, and you just go, I'm working too hard.
If I could just stop you for a second, the liberal thing, and I get it, is that, you know, the resentment of being taxed for wars.
Exactly.
The resentment of being taxed for corporate welfare.
Right.
The resentment of being taxed for, so that Exxon doesn't have to pay a dime.
That's
or
right.
General Electric. Mm-hmm. Or farm subsidies so that these big farmers can, you know, right. live it up.
Yeah.
And so both sides have these pieces that they deeply, deeply resent.
Right. And so where I was going with that is that in the Bush years, as far as I can see, and I'm not an expert about this, but just sort of standing back from it, is that actually the size of government, but this is the ironic thing, is that what Obama inherited from the Bush administration of 8 years was not a reduced government. Right. I mean, the classic conservative thing is we're going to reduce government. They didn't.
No.
They reemphasized where the spending was, but the debt was run up under Bush as much as it's being run up under, you know, Obama at this particular
Absolutely.
Point. Right. So this is what's really curious to me. As much as these ideologies can be argued, right, and you can say, well, there's one camp that wants less government and there's one camp that wants more. And yet when you actually see what's happened over the last 30 years with both camps getting their shot, less isn't on the table.
Exactly.
It's bigger. Now, it may be redistributed. You may say, well, Bush spent way more money on defense, but we still ran up the debt. I mean,
He also spent more money on the Medicare drug benefit, a huge new benefit unfunded.
Right.
You know, God love them.
Right.
Old people get the drugs they need. You know, it's a right thing for a society to do. The impulse to grow and continue to do things is online with both conservatives and Republicans. If human beings can do it, we want to do it.
Well,
you know, if we can take better care of ourselves, we want to do it.
Yeah.
If we can go make sure that they never attack us again, we can do it. Mm-hmm. And we, you know, there's just, that's that human thing. That's that erotic impulse in a way. And so, yeah, it's grown steadily.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, it kind of doesn't matter and it all goes away. I mean, we had the deficit hysteria back in the Reagan days and the Bush one days.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that all went away when the economy started growing. Under Clinton, and because growth solves these problems, but you know, this time,
and the question is
you know,
it different, right? Because
of
what's
happening
on the global
scene. We have so many
scene.
More old people. We have so much more, commitment that we want to do.
Right.
We don't realize that the government is actually us.
Right.
We see it as something other than us. That you know, we have that sort of sometimes the attitude that a 14-year-old kid has towards parents. It's like, give me that, do me that. You're supposed to take care of me.
Mm-hmm.
You're my parent,
right.
You know, and meanwhile, mom and dad are struggling to, you know, pay the rent.
Right.
And so we have that attitude towards the government that it's something that ought to do its thing instead of just basically the lower quadrants of our, you know, of reality, the
right.
systems and cultures and the ways that we adjudicate power and money. And actually, the truth is, David, it's jaw-dropping.
Mm-hmm.
The intelligent, sane systems that we have created politically.
Mm-hmm.
And I give honor to these crazy people who are called to politics for all kinds of reasons, including shadow and light, as
sure.
we all are. They're no different than we are.
Sure.
And they go there and they do their best to navigate this. And yes, they have to pander. And yes, they have to spin. But, you know, one of the things as integralists that we can appreciate is spinning and pandering as great progress.
Mm-hmm.
You know, who didn't spin and pander was Saddam Hussein
right.
and Stalin.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so, you know, it's good that we have that ultimately this crazy group of voters
right.
who have these motivations and different ways of seeing each other have actually now have to get real.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I think is happening
yeah.
is that we're, you know, we have this debt ceiling thing in the short term. We just finished the budget. We went to the last hour of the last night. and everybody walking out. And then finally, you know, so the government doesn't shut down because they do a deal. And now we have this debt ceiling thing, and this is kind of a sort of a pseudo fight number two about, you know, everybody getting their positions and stuff. And, you know, the downside is if we don't want to go to the last hour of the last night because it makes us look like idiots for the rest of the world. So we'll probably do it a little earlier than that, but it's going to be ugly. And, you know, but that's part of what we do. That's not a bad thing necessarily. And then the big fight will be the election coming up in 2012. Right. That's where the American people are going to have to make some decisions about how we're going to deal with, you know, these big, what is it, five things, taxes, medical care, Social Security, defense, and, you know, discretionary spending. Right. And so how are we going to balance that? Mm-hmm. Now, actually, the truth of the matter is that it's not that hard. I mean, if you took a jury of 12 reasonably intelligent people and gave them 2 days with the defense and the prosecution and the left and the right, they'd come up with what needs to be done. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a little of this, raise a little taxes here, raise the retirement age there, means test Medicare here, be careful of our foreign adventures, and, you know, invest in growth and, you know, work out the infrastructure. That's very similar to what the president's debt commission came up with. There's this gang of six in the six senators who are working offline, and they're both Republicans, you know, Saxby Chambliss and, you know, Dick Durbin, you know, together on that. And they're coming up with Tom Coburn. They're coming up with something that's where everybody hurts a little bit. And, you know, we move forward. So it's actually not like it's unsolvable. It's just that the American people, they're basically going to kill anybody who, one, raises taxes, or two, cuts spending. Right. And so there's going to be some suicide. This is, you know, why I actually, and I know my liberal friend says that Paul Ryan, you know, and what's courageous about taking from the poor and all this. I think Paul Ryan's a fucking hero, man. You know, he is committing Harry Caray, and the Republicans are going along, and, you know, it's almost like, do we even have to have this next election? But people will have to get real about that. And for those who aren't, you know, necessarily know what I'm talking about, Paul Ryan is the House leader who came up with the Republican budget that all Republicans in the House voted for and signed on for. That's significant. Yes. Where basically Medicare is privatized.
Right. It's turned, you know, just into block to put grants it simple. And yeah. Basically people get money to make their own decisions.
Exactly. Right. Which is the kiss of death. I know. But it's interesting because, you know, parties who are out of power tend to get more ideological. And that's the kiss of death because elections are won in the sort of messy, muddled middle, you know, where nobody's quite happy, but, you know, somebody gets 51% of the vote, you know. And he just, you know, this is so easily demagogued by the Democrats. I hate to see them do it because it actually is, I like what Ryan did in the sense that it's a radical idea that sort of at least breaks the ice of some of the calcified thinking. You know, I don't think we ought to do what he's saying, especially with Medicare. We need just a good, smart public system. Simple as that. I mean, it's not simple, but we need that is what I see. And I think that's what's coming. But, you know, God love them.
And I guess the question that's up, I mean, you've raised it a couple of times, is that the normal process is that these things, you know, come together. People have points of view. One party's in power, the other's out. You know, we see this normal part of politics. And sort of this view, if you look back on it and saying, yeah, everybody's posturing and all the rest of it. And you know what? They're going to make a deal. And ultimately, life is going to go on. The only time that gets questioned is that if there is this kind of third force, which is, in a sense, and this is the question about the United States, is it not just a, you know, a battle for control of the United States, but the United States' role in the world? Because since the Second World War, we've pretty much had it the way we wanted it. The dollar is the de facto currency, and that's allowed us to fund a lot of the, you know, you say, well, how do you keep printing money? Well, you keep printing money because the dollar is, you know, is basically the de facto world currency. Now, that's being challenged a bit, and everybody's going, what's China going to do with their all of their debt? And they're starting to do yen exchanges with different countries. The euro is kind of making noises about maybe it ought to be a more balanced system, so the dollar isn't the only choice.
as I read it, and again, I'm not an expert, that's a fundamental change from where it has been since the Second World War, and particularly for the United States. And because if something actually did start to take place there, if people lost confidence, and this is what I think is interesting, if they lost confidence in the United States leadership and the electorate's ability to find a way forward instead of just posturing and going into some stalemate. This is what's interesting to me about it. This outside force says, if you guys can't figure out something to do together, right, that actually not even balances your two views, but as you said, you know, a little here, a little there, whatever, then the possibility is we're going to lose confidence in the United States as a functioning power, which means that for your currency, it may be devalued, which, and then that's just a house of cards that starts to go into some sort of, you know, apocalyptic thinking. That's what's interesting to me, is that is it one of these times right now? Is there something, every now and then we'll see, is there something unique to this time, right? I mean, for instance, you can go back and look at these last two elections, because you talked about, and the election started right now, as you pointed out, right? I mean, this conversation is about the 2012 elections. So if we'd been sitting in 2006 where we were and said, could you see Obama coming? And you go, no. I mean, where was he? I mean, he just came out of nowhere, right? And there was this giant wave in 2008, which we all took part in. Celebration after 8 years and, you know, of the other, right? And now we get our guy. Then 2010, not 2 years later, even though we all said he's inherited a huge number of problems and, you know, just get used to it. It's ain't going to get fixed easily. 2010, the Republicans come surging back on something called the Tea Party, of all things, which sort of gets dismissed in the beginning as being these quacks. And yet you go, they're starting to elect people. Now, is it more than 20% of the electorate? We'll see. But certainly perception and influence, right? That they're something to be reckoned with, right? Is healthy. There is this resistance that comes in, you know, if you have a liberal point of view and say they're going to shake this up, right? So now, right, so 2010 goes back, all the, you know, Obama's finished, it's going to be this, and then you kind of go, well, yeah, but then where's your solution? So ultimately, the question I guess I have in my mind is this sort of third force, this reconciling force that says, no, you guys have to actually figure out a way forward.
Yeah.
You can no longer stay in your, because if you don't, it's not just that one side's going to win or stalemate or the rest of it. Actually, it may change the United States' role in the world. And maybe that is what is going to happen. But that certainly is another theme that is happening, not even in the background anymore, is that we see this global community coming online.
Yeah, and I think that that is basically evolution happening right on schedule, basically.
Yeah.
Where we see that there was a moment in time at the mid-20th century where after two world wars, the United States separated by two oceans and never really fought any of it in our own soil, really bestrode the world there for a while.
Yeah.
Not as long as you think, in a way, because the two countries that were, you know, decimated,
right,
Japan and Germany, actually were world powers within 15 years.
Right.
Here's, you say, what surprises are coming and stuff. I think there's more surprises on the upside to come. Like, who would have thought that?
Right.
And, you know, this whole idea that war begets war, and it, when you get to modernity, there's no more blood hatred.
Mm-hmm.
There's no more of that, you know, your grandfather did this to my grandfather. That's irrelevant.
Right.
It's not even interesting at modernity.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, you have this world that continues, and now we have Brazil, and we have China, and we have India, and we have Russia, and we have developed, you know, the tigers of the Vietnam and of the Southeast Asia and Singapore. And it's just amazing that we have created a global system that, you know, works as well as it does, people.
Mm-hmm.
Hello?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, that we still have, you know, God bless the Greeks. I was just reading about these retirement problems. They're the worst. You retire at 111% of your salary in Greece.
Mm-hmm.
You know, of course, this is why they're broke in, you know, the basket case of Europe. But, you know, God love them.
Right.
It's amusing and sweet to me in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the impulse, you know, is that we actually want to be more civilized. We want to have more trade.
Mm-hmm.
That trumps everything.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, the United States now, It's still, you know, the dollar's where everybody went during this last crisis. So the dollar's still it, basically. Yep. Right. But is that going to continue? It's not. Mm-hmm. But at some point, it's like there is, what I see is there's almost a de facto world currency mm-hmm. coming online mm-hmm. in fits and starts, in that we may still call it a dollar or a euro or a yen. But it's so intermeshed and so interpenetrated in terms of how it's sold and how it's how the currencies are thought of, that there's a de facto world currency coming online, just simply because we are all interpenetrated, intermeshed economically. So is that a smooth process? No. It's a bumpy process. And we see things like the real estate bubble burst in the United States. And now there's a farmland bubble forming in the Midwest of the United States. And there's a housing bubble forming in China. But we see these more. We just bring more intelligence. The global elite, simply because they have to make decisions that work, actually, I think, minimize the downside. When you think of that we had in this country real estate values drop 30% nationwide, and in cities like Vegas and Phoenix, 50, 60% in parts of Florida. I mean, that there weren't mass protests and riots in the street. Were there? No. You know, people recalibrated, people tightened their belts, they went to McDonald's instead of Red Lobster and whatever. And it's amazing how resilient and stable modernity is. I just would encourage integralists to actually have a little more faith in that, yes, there's going to be huge, you know, bumps, but they're actually, the big surprises, I think, are going to come on the upside. Mm-hmm. I mean, the fact that, let me just use another one, Obama. Yeah. So this, you know, state senator, 8 years ago in Illinois, just comes on the scene like this super guy and becomes a president of the United States, despite the fact that he's black and his middle name is Hussein. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Because there is an intelligence that is beyond the intelligence of any one of us that is at work here. I mean, I don't know how that happens, but I have some faith in it. And that's the, you know, just the ever emergent sanity that comes as we continue to grow up and see more and have bigger views. And as I've often pointed out, anybody these days who's operating at any kind of a leadership level, whether it's in a government, an NGO, a private company, a public company, education systems, whatever you might be doing, you have to be operating in a sort of de facto integral way, in the sense that you realize that you have to navigate other people's perspectives. You have to, if you're working overseas, not just see them as something to exploit, but as something to relate to in all four quadrants. And that's why, you know, you want the hockey stick. The hockey stick is consciousness. That's what's now, you know, we're basically riding a geyser of it. And I am, as always, quite hopeful in, you know, until the asteroid hits. That's my story, and I'm sticking with it.
I'm sticking to it. So, all right, but let's see if we can bring this back down and sort of close this in, because yes, we can look at the larger perspectives, but one of the things we say about integral, it also allows us to discern, right, that I'll do this versus that, right? So ultimately, we will have choices over the next couple of years, right? So that if I'm sitting here as I am, and not necessarily, I mean, seeing the issues actually with both positions and saying what's going to be the reconciling force here, right? That's what I want to put my energy into. In your mind, I mean, just in terms of how you may exercise that, at some point, votes are votes. I mean, you have to vote for somebody, and I suspect that we're going to vote for Obama, you and I, right? But still, there are some real questions. I mean, aside from the fact that I share your feeling about that he's a different kind of leadership, but just on the financial things alone, right? I mean, and this again surfaced this week when the question was raised, has any investment banker, given the meltdown of 2008, actually even been charged or gone to jail? And what's emerging out of the Goldman Sachs stuff that, you know, this one senator has the audacity to actually have a subcommittee on, so that he's actually asking the questions, is that
Elliot Spitzer the other night, who was, before his little personal problem, was going after these guys, and he was just, I've never seen him this angry on the, you know, I mean, or this passionate on the program, right, saying that there are laws that have been broken and nobody is willing to go after these guys. And certainly with Goldman Sachs, it looks like they play both sides of the fence, which is just bordering on the illegal, but, you know, certainly ethically. And when you look at Geithner and some of the Obama people, you say, well, this big bailout, right, that went to all of them, anybody else gotten a loan lately? I mean, there's all mm-hmm. that criticism. And so in a certain sense, I want to say, yeah, for me, Obama, yes. And I got a couple things that I want you to adjust, right? So I want to encourage you to not stick with that. I want to see some action in the other part. So do you have a sort of a similar feeling about how you're going to operate, you know, over these next couple of years?
Well, yeah, I would be supporting Obama. It's funny, actually, when you say that, I'm not so sure if I actually thought there was somebody better than Obama. You know, mm-hmm. I'm ruthless enough to sure. throw him under the bus, yes. actually. Mm-hmm. I don't see that person, but, I'm open. Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, it's going to be Obama. And I think we will have, I think what the game Obama's playing right now is he wants to win mm-hmm. The election. And so he's going to take a sort of a center-left position here. And he has, I mean, by, his strong critique of the Ryan plan,
yes.
Which thrilled the hearts of many liberals. And he's going to stand by, certain principles of taking care of old people and all that good stuff. Right. And so this battle's going to be fought. The Republicans, geez, I mean, they have dealt themselves a hand through being true believers and ideologues. And, you know, Paul Ryan is an Ayn Rand freak. And, right. you know, I mean, right. God love them. You know, they're going to go down in flames, in my opinion. And Obama will...
Well, or they'll capture their true believers. They're going to capture their 20%. True
believers. Exactly.
But they're a small group.
We may end up with a landslide.
Right.
Because people actually, when they really look at it, they don't want to really decrease spending on social programs. Not that much.
Well, the latest polls would say that. I mean, yeah. they're interesting when you look at them. Yeah. You say they do not want Medicare cuts. So these two things that the Republicans are fundamentally challenging, they don't seem to have public support. Right. And on the conservative side as well. But at the same time, Obama's ratings are down, and Congress's ratings are like in the toilet, right?
Right.
And so that tells me that, you know, some wild card, some X factor, as Obama was to a certain extent, and as the Tea Party was in 2010, right, mm-hmm. is people are looking, and if something emerges, you know, they're just so dissatisfied with the whole thing, is that we may actually see some surprises.
Yeah, and I think the surprise will be that after the election, we'll have a grand bargain led by Obama. My guess is, and predictions, I mean, it's interesting to see predictions are so often wrong.
Yes.
I mean, that's why, you know, from an integral perspective, you realize that there's... this is a little aside. There's always enough evidence mm-hmm. to support any perspective you want to take. Right. I mean, that's just the world that we live in. And so right. Reality is still doing its own thing. Mm-hmm. So anyway, back to Obama. Just back to the bigger political system. So mm-hmm. we have people who don't want to cut, you know, social programs. And when they really look at that, they'd like a big government there. Mm-hmm. Okay. The second thing is that people are getting hip to the fact that the rich got too much richer mm-hmm. and that may have to be readjusted.
Right.
And there's a pretty strong majority of people who support tax increases on, you know, the so-called rich, right. whether it's 250,000, a million, however you want to cut, slice and dice that. Mm-hmm. There's movement to that. Mm-hmm. The other thing is that there is actually a ever-emerging consensus in the population at large, that the financial system is, you know, it's brilliant. When you look at the amount of trade and, you know, everything that's going on in the world, and just amazing, really net, this system of intelligence that is operating at all is amazing. And it's also rigged. It's tuned and it's spun mm-hmm. to the benefit of the people who are doing it. And that's always going to be the case. We can live with that, but it's gotten too far. It's gotten too extreme. Mm-hmm. I think that that there's a meta realization that we have to regulate that more, mm-hmm. that it's rigged in a way that is just untenable. It doesn't feel right. that Wall Street bankers should be paid hundreds of millions of dollars just because they're the ones who are managing the trillions of dollars that are flowing through the system. That just doesn't pass the smell test. So I think actually we're going to see a very interesting Obama after he doesn't have to run for re-election again, as we did with Clinton, and as we did with Bush in a certain way.
Sure.
You know, with
That thing happens is that I'm not running again, so I'm
exactly.
I've got my,
I actually can be who I want to be and be a historic president who really does solve the real problems.
Yeah.
And again, you put 12 people from the phone book in a room; it's not that hard to figure out what has to be done. And, you know, everybody hurts a little bit, and it's, you know, we tax the rich, we means test a little bit, we raise the retirement age a little bit, we, you know, bring some of our troops home, we figure out how we're going to allow for, you know, these countries to be violent while we're televising it, you know, I mean, and these are the issues that humanity's facing now. But I would just argue that we've reached a level of almost permanent acquisition. In the sense that, you know, at some point, human beings got a permanent acquisition of language. They didn't forget it. You know, language was just there, and it's never gone away, and it's never going to go away. Also, evolutionarily, we can see that we're moving into just intelligence and flexibility of systems. And also a consensus worldwide about, you know, basic free flow of information and goods, and, you know, everybody wants to be knitted into the whole. There's, you know, aside from North Korea and a couple outliers like that, it's amazing consensus around these principles of basically modernity and postmodernity that are stable and allow for a lot of creativity in how, you know, you see this a lot in Boulder, David, with people in our generation looking at new ways to live together as old people in houses, and just surprising new things that actually are rich and take us closer to a meaningful, decent life that is connected with our own spirit. And we're not just, you know, expecting it to be delivered. And, you know, all of these are just the thousand ways that we wake up. You know, each of us individually, and as a result, all of us collectively.
Well, this we know one thing for sure, because we're going to close this off for today, is that this is just the beginning of this conversation. I mean, there are forces at foot, and yes, part of them are normal with elections, but there's also global situations on almost every front that you look at that are connected to this. I mean, for instance, Japan. I mean, you kind of go, well, that is a terrible event and all the rest of it, but think about where Japan's going to get the money to rebuild their country, right? Biggest crisis they've had since the Second World War. Well, they're the second biggest holder of U.S. debt, so they're going to have to cash some of that. So what is that, right? So even these things that are environmental, acts of God, if you will, right, or whatever you believe about them, all figure into this, right? Because it all somehow gets back to the financial system and to each of us individually. What I'm really going to encourage the audience to do is just weigh in on this, right? And in terms of how are you seeing it in your own life, where would you go if you actually were on that jury that you mentioned, or that you were the one that was deciding on the committee about here are these very simple yet very complex problems? You can't spend too much than you make. We all know this in our personal lives, and yet we run up debt and we do this and we like the lifestyle that brings us. So, you know, these are not simplistic questions in a certain sense. So thank you very much for setting the stage, which I think is going to be a fascinating conversation.
Always interesting, isn't it?
We roll through to 2012.
Yeah.
All right.
What fun.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thanks, David.